Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Robert Grillo, has spent many years questioning how our culture conditions us to consume animals and contributes to an immense underworld of suffering. As a young man, Robert had freelance gigs at several advertising agencies. At one long-term assignment, he worked on McDonald's Happy Meal boxes and Kraft Foods branding, packaging, and signage. In his new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture, Robert Grillo explores how popular culture uses a set of fictions to shape our beliefs and our perceptions of farmed animals and manipulate our food choices. He writes that the engine behind this cultural indoctrination is largely animal agriculture branding, which props up a fictional world so entrenched in our minds that we stopped questioning it a long time ago. A fictional world that tells us what we want to hear, shows us what we want to see, and ultimately reflects back upon us and what we want to believe. So why do so many people eat animals when we now have so many alternatives? We now have more scientific data than ever about how animal ag affects our health and the environment. So ultimately, what drives your food choices? Robert Grillo is founder and director of Free From Harm, a nonprofit animal rescue, education, and advocacy organization. And he's the author of the new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. Robert has a number of events in the next couple of days. He'll be giving his Farm to Fable presentation tonight at 6 at the Rancho Cordova Library in Sacramento, 9845 Folsom Boulevard. Friday night at 7, he'll be at the Berkeley Animal Rights Center, 2425 Channing Way. Saturday at 2, he'll be at the Sonoma County Veg Fest. It's at the Luther Burbank Center in Santa Rosa. And Sunday at 1, he'll be at Animal Places Vegan Republic in Berkeley, 1624 University. And right now, he joins us in studio. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. You are a busy man. I understand you just got back from an animal rights conference in Washington, D.C.
Yes, right. Over the weekend.
You know, it's been amazing to watch things change around this issue of animal rights. And you're right now writing a book just about how popular culture affects our decisions. You've been spending a number of years really thinking about this.
I have, yeah. I think at a certain point I realized that there was so much good material and so many good sources and speakers and books and resources for people that wanted to go vegan or that wanted to make a, you know, have a case for it, whether it be the ethical or environmental or health argument, which are all valid and great arguments. But what I realized was there was very little I could find that really looked at, under a microscope, looked at the rest of society. I mean, why is the onus on us to explain why the world would be a better place with less suffering? That seems to be something that almost everyone agrees to, that to reduce your harm in the world is a good thing. So I never felt really in my heart that it was up to us to explain why this is the right path in life. To me, it was the burden of you know, the ethical situation or argument was on the rest of society to explain, like you said earlier, why in an age when we could, most of us could easily make other choices, would we continue to do this? And that's what led me to find that it was really popular culture that was driving it. And the engine behind popular culture is the animal exploitation industries, which are flooding us with narratives. They're using the media in ways that are flooding us with those false narratives keep us on track, keep us from questioning it.
You have personal experience with this because, as I said, when you were a young man, you had freelance gigs at several advertising agencies. And at one long-term assignment, you worked on McDonald's Happy Meal boxes. And in your book, you write that, "I never once saw the problem with the portrayal of happy animals on the package containing the body parts of other animals who lived miserable lives. And it never occurred to me at the time how this branding was intentionally sending mixed messages to children." At what point did you realize that there was such a huge disconnect happening?
I think when I started to see what things were really like and not what they were on the package or what I was told by, you know, the fox minding the hen house, which is the industry which keeps animals away from view and their practices away from view. And when I finally, you know, we know without knowing, it's like we know throughout our lives that these animals are commodified and used for food, but the reality doesn't really sink in for most of us. And unfortunately, in my life, it didn't happen until I was in my 40s.
Hmm.
So I think it was actually, you know, coming across undercover investigative footage and certain films that were really the catalyst for me to, you know, to unravel all this.
You write about what happened in 2009 when you made an impulsive move to adopt three chicks and you named them Doris, Danita, and Ricardo.
That's right.
How did you come to adopt these chicks?
Well, a good friend of mine is a school teacher in Chicago, in a Chicago public school. And unfortunately, what happens in these programs is the school buys the incubated eggs and then they hatch. And this is supposed to be such a great learning experience for the children, right? But then what they're faced with is all these bouncing baby chicks that have no home, right? And some of them are going to be roosters. And of course, these towns and cities have different ordinances where some only allow hens and not roosters, or don't allow chickens at all. And so these programs create a dilemma in finding homes for these birds. And so I decided to impulsively take three chicks. They were all so beautiful. There were 19 of them, and I felt so bad that I could only take three, but I just picked one, that one here, one there, and the third one. And when I walked away, I felt really bad because the rest were kind of left behind, and I thought, who knows what's going to happen to them. I should say, too, that the I'll add real briefly that the Museum of Science and Industry has a chick hatching program where thousands of chicks are hatched there so that children can see how cute they are. And then they're sent to the Lincoln Park Zoo, and they're suffocated and killed, and they're fed to their reptiles.
Oh.
So in order to create entertainment, one institution uses chicks from, you know, another that's using those baby chicks for entertainment. So it's kind of a cycle of exploitation going on.
And to that point, you write that most people do not see slaughterhouses. We rarely see animals confined unless you live near one. Mm-hmm. If you live in a big city, chances are you don't see it at all. But because of social media, and then there's so much new science out there now about the treatment of animals, mm-hmm. and about cognitive behavior of animals. So since you brought up chickens, let's talk about this, because you have an incredible section on chickens, mm-hmm. in your book. And you write that 8.7 billion chickens in the United States and 40 billion globally are slaughtered every year at around 6 weeks of age. I think the numbers a lot of people don't know either. I mean, even mm-hmm. when I read a lot about these issues, mm-hmm. but even when I see the numbers, they're still shocking to me.
Right.
8.7 billion chickens in the United States, 40 billion globally are slaughtered every year at around 6 weeks of age. And this is just chickens.
Right. Right. And another way of another statistic that's pretty shocking is that in the U.S. alone, somewhere between 275 and 300 six-week-old chickens have their throats slashed every second in the U.S., close to 300.
The other thing that's interesting is we don't associate this with companies. You often hear about slaughterhouses. You mm-hmm. hear about animal exploitation. But other than, say, a Foster Farms, I'm sure a lot of people don't know the names of some of these companies that are raising and killing these chickens and the
right.
profits that they're making.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that they're being sent to these slaughterhouses, regardless of where they were raised, they're going to be, you know, caught when they're of age, of market weight, they say, and then taken to these slaughterhouses. Lots of farms, even especially the smaller ones, the ones that I've talked to, say they don't even deal with slaughter. They don't see any of the violence. They raise their animals, and they're very proud of the way they raise them. But when it comes time to pick up the calves that are unwanted from the dairy industry, or the hens that are no longer producing eggs that they need to replace or whatever, they don't see any. They send them off. They have someone pick them up, and they never see what happens to them.
What did you learn specifically about how our culture shapes our opinions about chickens?
Well, they are, I would say, unfortunately, dismally degraded in our culture. And in some of my examples in my book, in my presentation, I demonstrate that. So, for instance, in the movie Rebel Without a Cause, which is a landmark kind of New Age film about the main plot of the film is based on a game called the Chicken Run. And so two people run a car off of a cliff, and the person who jumps out of the car last is the winner. Well, something went terribly wrong in this movie because the guy couldn't get out of his car. But anyway, James Dean, who plays the protagonist, he feels really bad because the other guy died. But the reason why he decided to play this dangerous game and jump, drive the car off the cliff was because they were calling him a chicken and a coward if he didn't. Mm. And so most people walked away from that film thinking this has, nothing to do with chickens, but it actually had everything to do with the reputation of chickens in our culture, because we denigrate animals and give them human qualities that we find undesirable, like pigs and chickens and cows and all that. And unfortunately, they're oftentimes farm animals, the ones that we actually want to exploit by the billions.
You write that a recent high-profile study of chicken behavior by Christine Nickel credits chickens with the ability to perform complex skills within days of hatching, such as basic arithmetic, self-control, and basic structural engineering, skills that do not develop in humans until their toddler years. The mass media turned these comparisons into catchy headlines like, "Can chickens really be cleverer than a toddler?" And you go on to write about how they are really good at basic arithmetic, geometry, physics, advanced problem solving, and quick learning and retention.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really remarkable. Some of the scientific studies that have been done in the last 10 or 15 years completely revolutionize what we know. And it should revolutionize our perception and change it. It should definitely change our perception of chickens for the better. But that remains to be seen, because most of society isn't even aware of what's been studied yet. And the fact is, even if chickens weren't so precocious, even if they weren't so incredibly aware of their surroundings, like I live with chickens and I see what they're like every day, I find them to be incredibly aware and sensitive of their surroundings and so attached to us, the ones, their caretakers, following us around, an incredible zest for life. They really live in the moment and also think about the future, it turns out. But even if they weren't all of these things, at the very core, they're just like us in terms of what matters, in terms of wanting to live and not wanting to suffer, and just like any other animal that we would admire as a companion animal, like a dog or a cat, for example.
Today we're speaking with Robert Grillo. He's founder and director of Free From Harm, a nonprofit animal rescue education and advocacy organization. And he's author of the new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal Consuming Culture. And he has spent many years really looking at why so many Americans continue to consume animals when we now have so many alternatives. When you think about these issues, what really shapes your food choices? What drives your food choices? And with so many documentaries out there, new science, so many undercover videos that are very difficult to watch in many cases, a lot of new data and science about how the animal ag industry affects the environment and our health, how have your views about this issue changed over the years? If you saw a video that really stood out for you, if you heard a radio show, or if you saw a documentary, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. What do you think about how culture really shapes our opinions about animals? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. You also write about cows and how culture shapes our perceptions of cows. And you report that more than 3 million young dairy cows are slaughtered and processed into ground beef every year in the United States. 80% of dairy cows are forcibly impregnated repeatedly in a crude procedure. Talk a little bit about how culture shapes our opinions of cows. I think about all the books I read when I was young, and cows, I feel like we're one of the main animals. I grew up in Petaluma, mm-hmm. Which used to have a heck of a lot of agriculture. It's changed now. But, you know, we drove by the dairy cow yeah. ranches, the chicken cow chicken ranches. Mm-hmm. You could smell it, really. I mean, it was yeah. part of the culture.
Well, you know, one of the ways I've learned is just through firsthand eyewitness experiences, visiting farms. Like a couple of years ago, I actually was taking a drive on Sir Francis Drake Boulevard in Marin County, and I came across a small dairy farm which looked like it had about 40 or 50 cows, adult cows, and I decided just to pull over. And luckily, the owner was there. It was a young man, came out, and I basically did a very impromptu interview, and I asked him all kinds of questions about farming, dairy farming. It had been in his family for generations. The little frame house that he lived in was right across the street from where the dairy operation was. And, you know, what I learned there was that that this operation on a very small scale, organic, pasture-based, grass-fed, all the mm-hmm. buzzwords, right, that make people give the feel-good feel inside, the old McDonald's farm feeling. All of this was on a small scale, but it was all the same things that you would find done on a large farm. In fact, there were no cows on pasture because you can't milk cows when they're out on pasture. They have to be in a holding pen so that they can be easily led to and from the milking parlor because they're going to be milked several times in a week. So, you know, you can't just have them off on pasture and then try to get them in. It just doesn't work that way. So they were, all of the cows, except for one in the distance that was actually a dead cow, all of them were in a holding pen, which up to their ankles in mud and manure, and their babies were in plastic hutches on the other side of the milking parlor where the milking machines are, on the other side of that. All rows and rows of plastic hutches, each with one little female newborn. And he took me over there, and I came up to some of these calves, and some of them came up to me. Some of them were terrified and just were crouched in the corner of their little plastic hutch. And this is going to be their lives for the first some months of their life. And so I think, you know, what he wanted to do was be very transparent, and I really appreciate the fact that he gave me that experience, the honesty and the transparency. But I could clearly see that his apathy was 100% dead proof. Like, there's no way you're going to penetrate that. This is our business. And yeah, when the male calves are born, someone comes and picks them up, and I never see what happens, never experiences the violence. And so, you know, but what you ask about earlier is what shapes our perception. Unfortunately, it's things like Stonyfield Farms and Ben & Jerry's, which Ben & Jerry's is kind of famous for this anonymous dairy Holstein cow artwork, which is a faceless, anonymous dairy cow with just the black and white pattern in it. And no personality, no individual person or someone there. It's just a silhouette. And that's what they want us to believe, that these cows are just interchangeable. They're anonymous. They're just, they're clones. They're not worth anything except what they can produce for us.
And Robert Griller reports that more than 3 million young dairy cows are slaughtered and processed into ground beef every year in the United States. Robert is author of the new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal Consuming Culture. And let's hear from Suzanne in San Francisco. Or Susan. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I are in our 70s and have eaten meat and dairy all our lives. We have a granddaughter who has recently turned vegan. She also has to be gluten-free. It's a real problem to feed her, I always think, when she visits. Not a huge problem, but a big one. Recently, we saw I caught a film on Netflix, What the Health. I'm sorry I can't tell you who made it, but I think it's still available there. What the Health.
Right.
And it was, you know, an hour and a half of the horrors of an animal diet, mostly talking about the health benefits of eating vegan. And I was so excited. I told my husband all about it. He was asking questions which I couldn't answer thoroughly. He watched the film. We both decided to try the vegan diet for our health and for the animals. And I recommend that film to everyone.
Susan, how's it going?
Well, we're currently sort of vegetarian. I said I'm going to clear the pantry and the refrigerator first. I hate waste. So cheese lovers, it's going down. It's almost gone. No meat for several weeks. And it's fine. It's fine. It's going to be fine. I mean, we stopped eating fast food, you know, decades and decades and decades ago, and the smell of McDonald's makes us ill when we have to pass by it or any other, you know, deep fat fried food. But it's going to, I'm just telling, encouraging my husband and myself and saying we're going to get over even liking the smell of ribs on Divisadero Street, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get over it. It'll pass.
I'd love to add something to what you said in that, you know, we're so fortunate to live in an age where we can actually, you know, I have a smoked bacon, seitan bacon product that is actually made in Chicago where I'm from. It's a company called Upton Naturals. And I love making BLTs from that. So I think, you know, we're so fortunate that we live in an age where we have lots of great plant-based products and then, that give us some of the same taste and texture, because food is really color, texture, and flavor. And I think, you know, some of these companies are doing a wonderful job of getting there with a plant-based meats and cheeses. And it's just, you know, we just need to seek them out, need to ask for them at the store and the restaurant.
That relates to Greg's question. He says, I know it's hard for a vegetarian to comprehend, but a lot of people like the taste of meat. The meat production industry is horrific, and all he says, I'm wondering if you and your guests like the taste of meat. If not, did you ever like the taste of meat, and did you have to overcome meat eating like a drug addiction?
I never thought I was addicted, but I was raised in a family. I was raised in an Italian family, an immigrant Italian family, where meat was a sign of progress and of the American dream. I mean, my grandparents ate very little to no meat in Italy, where they came from. It was an afterthought. It was never a main course. But then, you know, when you come to the States, eating animals and big steaks and lots of cheese and dairy is a sign of status. And so for that generation, I think that's changing now because we're realizing that those were just subsidized industries for the most part. I never felt addicted to it. And as I said, those flavors that we crave when it comes to animal products, we can obtain now with the plant-based products out there. And it's just a bit of a shift in our palate, but once we make that, you know, that transition, we're there.
Thank you for the email, Greg. Today we're speaking with Robert Grillo. He's founder and director of the organization Free From Harm. It's an animal rescue and advocacy organization. And he's speaking with us today about his new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal Consuming Culture. And he has spent many, many years thinking about what shapes our beliefs and our perceptions about animals. Robert will be speaking over the next couple of days. I'll give that information right after this short break. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. Lines are filled up, but so if you get a busy signal, you're always welcome to write to us. Our email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment at our website, yourcallradio.org, or you may tweet us at yourcallradio. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be having an hour-long conversation about the future of right-wing media. Sinclair has a huge bid to buy Tribune, and then we just recently learned about this new Trump TV. So we're going to talk about all of that tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Robert Grillo. He is talking about his new book, Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. And he'll be giving his Farm to Fable presentation tonight at the Rancho Cordova Library in Sacramento, 9845 Folsom Boulevard. Friday night at 7, he'll be at the Berkeley Animal Rights Center, 2425 Channing Way. Saturday at 2 o'clock, he'll be at the Sonoma County Veg Fest at the Luther Burbank Center in Santa Rosa. Sunday at 1, he'll be at Animal Places Vegan Republic in Berkeley, 1624 University. And if you'd like to weigh in on this topic and this question about what shapes your beliefs and your perceptions about animals, how do you make your food choices, we'd love to hear from you. We have full lines. We'll have one open in a couple minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Let's go next to Anna in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I love your show, and thank you so much for having me on. I just wanted to say that I randomly ran into a person who works over at Costco in San Francisco in their deli department, and the person was telling me that she works from 10 in the morning till 6 at night in the deli department where she roasts chickens every day, and she has 8 ovens and 30 on a tray, and those 8 ovens are going from 10 in the morning until literally 6 o'clock at night when she's out. And that there's like at least 1,000 chickens that go out, and they're very inexpensive over there. They're like $5 for a chicken, a roasted chicken. And that people come in and they buy like 5 of them at one time, and just, you know, without thought. And, you know, I think part of it is, you know, the convenience of like having something filling and what tastes good to people, and then just not even thinking about it. It's just so easy and inexpensive and mm-hmm. feeds a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Right. You address this in your book.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we're just seeing such a small slice of reality.
That's one Costco out of how many across the country?
Exactly.
Right?
And what they're showing us is such a small, it's not even reality. It's just an abstract object, right? So I was just on Facebook yesterday and I got a glimpse of what really happens and what the true cost of that product is. I looked at a 20-second video of a vigil of a person who took a video with her phone of a chicken that was gasping for air outside of the trucks, the crate that was loaded on a truck, her little beak out just gasping for air, and the trauma on that bird's face is enough to haunt you for a lifetime. I think, again, there are so many wonderful products out there that we could replace that with, and once we're aware of their reality, and we shift, you know, we actually look at what's happening and not just what the food industry wants us to see, then we have the possibility of major transformation in our society.
What are your thoughts about, can you explore more about the disconnect? Because I think about how we hear about gun violence on a regular basis, and there's so much happening overseas,
yeah.
And because of social media, a lot of us, it's hard to take it, but I think we're moving so quickly, and so I think the disconnect becomes even wider. How do you tackle that issue?
Well, you know, I think we need to have a more of a intersectional view of our world. I think it you know, the world, the age we're living in demands it. But we can do lots of things at the same time. That's the wonderful thing about being human, is you can do things that help the environment and also perhaps promote peace and justice in the world. And that just so happens to benefit other species. So everything we do to help animals is inevitably going to help vulnerable human groups. It's going to help curb pollution and climate change. and social, other social injustices and social inequality, all of these issues of exploitation and oppression are connected because the oppressors are the same.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing that story, Anna. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. You asked what persuaded individuals who changed to being vegetarian or vegan. And my rationale was more calculated than either romantic or sexy. I had read Diet for a Small Planet by Frances Moore LePay, and when she addressed how much more efficient it was in terms of all resources to not eat animals, that's what convinced me.
And when what, that was a while ago, Ruthann.
A very long time ago. It was like 30, 40 years ago.
Wow. Well, thank you for that story. We're going to take a few more calls since we have full lines, and then we'll get a response from Robert Grillo. Let's go to Amy in San Francisco. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was raised in the United States from a middle-class family. We ate meat all the time. Then 30 years ago, I married a man from India who's a Hindu. Now, of course, in addressing your question of how culture affects our ideas of animals, being a Hindu in India, you do not eat meat, especially cows. They're sacred. He was raised in New Delhi. I've been there. It's really something to see all these cows roaming around the street. And it's very sad that there's now, under Modi, a lot of violence that's being created about Hindus who do not want to slaughter cows and Muslims who do. That's just an aside, but an important one internationally. But 30 years ago when I married this man, he had eaten vegetarianly his whole life, grains, beans, no meat, vegetables. He's 69. His doctors all tell him he has the body of a man 20 years younger than his age, extremely healthy. And I have not eaten meat since I married him. So I just thought that was interesting on how culture affects us. And I never missed meat. I'm lucky that I married an Indian man who loves to cook. That's a little unusual. But, boy, he's a great cook. I love his cooking. And if he's not here, I cook like he does.
And how do you feel today, Amy?
I feel fine. I feel like my life changed for the better 30 years ago.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to take a few more calls, and then we'll get Robert's response. Let's go to Tom in Hayward. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. This is slightly off topic, but I hope you'll bear with me. 4 years ago, I was stranded in a parking lot, and on a rainy January morning, a rooster wandered into my life. I was stranded there because I had lost my housing. I had lost almost everything I owned. I was in the deepest and the worst depression of my life. That rooster did as much for me as my therapists and medication to help bring me out of the depression. He would follow me around. When I sat down, he would come and sit next to me. And I sometimes, when I'm just doing things on my own, I sing. Sometimes it doesn't even make sense. I'm making up the words as I go along. And the next thing I knew, there he was singing right with me. If I am ever in a situation again where I can have a pet, one of the things I would like to have is another rooster.
Wow.
He was absolutely gorgeous. I think it's, it has a Filipino name, if I'm not mistaken. He was just glorious, red, orange. He looked like he was on fire with his breast, and most of his body was dark blue. Oh, he was stunning. Unfortunately, I think he met a sad demise because one of the things that happened along the way is one of the fake claws fell off of the claw that had been cut off. And the person who came in and took him away against my wishes, and I tried to save him, I know is involved in fighting. So anyway, thank you for letting me tell the story. I'm trying to wean myself off eating as much meat as I do, but when you have no place to cook, sometimes you're stuck with fast food. So anyway.
Right. Well, Tom, thank you. That was the sweetest story I've heard all month, and I hope you can find maybe another rescue rooster to add so much love to your life. On this point, Tom said that he doesn't have a place to cook. We also have an email from Janelle who says she's now living in southern Baja. She used to be vegetarian, but it's really hard to find food. What advice would you give to Tom first? I mean, a lot of people are living in SROs, and they don't have places to cook.
Right. Yeah, that's a problem. I realize that creates challenges, and I think that luckily we live in an age where, you know, legumes and grains and packaged products and fast food, and, you know, like, if that's our only option, there's still options that are free of animal products. I think, I'm familiar with some of the food deserts in Chicago, for example.
We have them here.
And you have them here.
Yep.
And, you know, the options are so less than, you know, many of us. And hopefully it'll get better. And I think that our activism has to account for food deserts and bringing better options.
Yeah, I mean, this is also a food justice issue. Like,
absolutely.
The Food Empowerment Project is a vegan advocacy food justice organization that focuses specifically on communities that have food deserts.
Right.
Low-income communities of color. It's very connected to all of this. Because the meat and dairy industries are subsidized, which allows the fast food to be under $5 for a meal.
Exactly. Right. There's also an organization called A Well-Fed World that does this internationally and goes into areas where there's heavy livestock industries where they and tries to help these people go to crops where they could actually feed a lot more people that are hungry.
Well, thank you so much for calling in with that story, Tom. Today we're speaking with Robert Grillo, founder and director of Free From Harm, a nonprofit animal rescue organization. And his new book is Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal Consuming Culture. Let's go next to Lola in Richmond. Hi, Lola. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. I grew up, I was a vegetarian, a vegan, macrobiotic. My mother owned a health food store in the 70s, and we ate a lot of soy. And in the end, it became very harming to all of us, disrupting hormones and all that stuff. And I'm not a vegan or vegetarian now. I'm more on the paleo tip. And my comment and my life experience led me to flip the switch, and I hate to be a downer, but there's so many vegan, vegetarian options that are so processed, soy-driven, wheat-driven, that aren't really healthy for you. And I think, yes, vegetables are good, grains are good, but there's so many processed options. And when you go to the most expensive vegan restaurants, famous ones, it's all soy driven. Everything is soy, and soy's not good.
I'd love to comment on that.
Please.
I'd love to comment on that only because, you know, first of all, the soy fear-mongering that we see in our culture, which is something I discuss a little bit in my book, is largely driven by the animal exploitation industries, because they realize that soy is one of the most perfect superfoods that there is. It has, just like other beans, it has an incredible level of nutrients that we need, micronutrients and fiber and protein, and sometimes in a complete protein form. So they're really superfoods, and soybean is no exception. I mean, you can eat edamame, you can eat, you don't have to eat processed soy.
Because a lot of it is genetically modified, a
right,
lot of soy.
Most of that goes for animal feed is, a lot of it that is for human consumption is not. But the larger point is it's highly ironic, and this is a testament to the fictions that have indoctrinated us, that animal products are actually natural, and that dairy products and flesh and the secretions of animals are a natural product. They are far from natural. The processes and practices of animal farming today are so unnatural. If you really look at them, what you're eating is something that has an animal that has been fed an unnatural diet, unnatural conditions. Pharmaceuticals, 70% of the pharmaceutical industry produces drugs that go into animals, and they're not just antibiotics. They're all kinds of other drugs. So the idea that animal products are real and the alternative plant alternatives are the fakes is marketing. The real logo, the real dairy logo, has been around for decades, and it's driven into our minds that the secretions of this cow is real, regardless of how it was produced, regardless of how artificial the process is, and that soy milk is fake because it's coming from a bean. Hmm. It's that simple.
Well, you are in the capital of the local, organic, responsibly grown, humane part of the country, and a lot of people in the Bay Area, Northern California, eat these foods. Humanely raised beef, for example. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure the labels. can you give us some of these examples? I'm sure there's so many more.
We call this
antibiotics, antibiotic-free.
Responsibly raised, grass-fed, pasture-based. We just did a panel at the Animal Rights Conference on humane washing. I have a major chapter in my book on humane washing because it's such an important fiction. This is animal agriculture's key strategy to deflect attention away from what the vegan platform offers, which is a way to get out of all this, a way to get out of all this exploitation and violence. It's a way for us to to move away from that finally, because we can do it now. And what they're saying is, we have products that not only satisfy your appetite, but also your conscience, so you can have your cake and eat it too. But think about it. Even if I'm just going to put this one point out there, because there's so many myths in this humane movement, and their practices are not significantly different or better. But even if they were, the point is, the humane movement claims that they raise animals that get to know them, give them names, that form relationships with those animals, maybe even give them an individual name and treat them like an individual animal, all the while with the intention of betraying the animal at an infant or adolescent age to violently take their lives so that they can hack up their body and make some kind of profit off of their body. It's so sad to think, that these animals actually trust us on such a total level, and that our intention is to betray their trust. Is it really worth it? Mm-hmm. Is it really worth that betrayal, the ultimate betrayal, I would argue, when we could easily make another choice?
Well, thank you for calling in. One more question about the soy and GMO, because I'm sure a lot of people are curious about this. If you buy a package of edamame, for example, and it doesn't say non-GMO, mm-hmm. Is it or not? How do you find out?
I don't know. I have to admit, I have a big disclaimer here, is that I'm not any kind of nutrition expert at all. My book deals with the fictions and the way propaganda and storytelling is used by our culture to condition us to continue consuming animals. Mm. But I do think we, as far as soy goes, I think we can find non-GMO or organic soy products pretty easily, and it usually pretty clearly states that. So I don't think that's a big issue. But
all right. Well, thank you for calling. Let's go to Dorothy in San Francisco. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. It's a very interesting program. For the record, I have not eaten red meat or poultry in over 40 years. I would respectfully point out, however, that people do have food sensitivities that has nothing to do with industry propaganda. I can't eat much soy, for example. I have a friend who's very sensitive to soy. Others can't eat gluten or nuts, and those are the things on which meat substitutes are based. And so I think that again, people's bodies don't all work the same way, and I think that maybe a little more latitude might be shown here. I have run into this sort of thing from other vegans, and I certainly respect the choice, but not all of us can do it. I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. And we just published an article on our website by a dietitian who actually shows quite a bit of evidence that humans are this popular argument today with certain nutritionists and dietitians that there's many different body types and therefore different kinds of diets is actually not there's not a lot of evidence for that. That there's a lot more evidence for the fact that we are one species, and just like other species, other mammals, we don't require diverse nutritional needs. We all have very similar nutritional needs, and we can obtain those nutritional needs from plant sources. That doesn't mean we have to get it all from soy. We could go to lentils. We can go to flax seeds. We have so many options. I mean, if we can't do it, as the richest country in the world, the most affluent people in the West, if we can't do this, then I wonder who could.
What advice would you give people, though? Because we have another email along the same lines from Peggy, who says, I have difficulty digesting legumes, and I'm advised that over-reliance on grains as a source of protein is not healthy. Therefore, I cannot get adequate protein without meat or seafood.
Right. So these go into more nutritional questions that that aren't really my expertise. But I will say that there's an awful lot of There's a lot of misinformation out there, and unfortunately, there's lots of obstacles because these are psychological obstacles for us to really embracing a plant-based diet, because we think that we're going to lack the nutrients we need, or we're not going to feel satiated, and all these things. But I guess if you really have the mind to do it, then I think most people will find a way. They will find the right combination of foods that agree with them, and your body changes too. When it comes to legumes, I understand that most people who eat legumes on a regular basis, that their body starts producing certain kinds of enzymes that actually help digest them. So it takes time for some people maybe, but you got to experiment with the combinations.
Hmm. Well, thank you for calling in. Let's go next. Oh, actually, Yael could not stay with us, but she wanted to know, how do we introduce our kids to a vegetarian diet?
That's a good question. I would take them to, first of all, I think the diet is the result of our work. So I would say, take them to a sanctuary. Introduce them to farm animals that have been rescued from the farming industry, that were once exploited or once abused, and are now living off their lives in peace and harmony in a sanctuary by people that actually, respect them as individuals, and they get to express their personalities as individuals. Take your children to meet these animals. And then the process of finding the food will be actually, kind of natural from there. I think children have a natural empathy for all animals until we teach them to discriminate against certain ones.
The sanctuary movement has also grown. Jon Stewart left The Daily Show, and his wife started a sanctuary in New York, and now he's rescuing cows and pigs. It's kind of funny to watch, but there's also one in the Bay Area about an hour from here. You can find it if you search for sanctuary. But this is starting to really take off.
Yeah, at the conference, the animal rights conference, there was actually there's a micro sanctuary project, and it's for people that really want to do this on a small scale rather than like the level of farm sanctuary or one of these big ones where they have animal place, like have hundreds of animals. These are people that just want the experience of rescue, and also opening that up as an experience to the public, perhaps. So there's something called the micro sanctuary movement, which is really interesting.
We have a comment on our Facebook page from Jane, who says, shiitake mushrooms fried in a little olive oil and salted and cooked till crisp, tastes like bacon, only better. We have just a couple minutes, but I wanted to get your take on this bacon thing, because, people love cracking jokes about bacon. I've gone to a bunch of craft fairs in San Francisco where everything is covered in ice cream, candied bacon. I mean, what is it about bacon? I know that there was a massive marketing push by the pork industry to get bacon to be sort of hip and cool, and they've really succeeded at doing that.
Right.
But what is it about bacon?
Salt and fat. I mean, just like cheese, salt and fat. We crave salt and fat. And if it's marketed right, boy, we eat it up.
And what about the culture behind bacon and it's almost like there's a disconnect between where it comes from, pigs and bacon.
Right. Well, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of things we could read into that. I think one of the things I read into it is that we like to consume animal products, and we like the way it feels because subconsciously we want to dominate other species in this planet. We want to be on top.
To that point, one of the concepts you tackle in your book is that of consent, the idea that animals are willing participants in this process.
Yes, absolutely.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. This is one of the most ancient fictions that we know of. Even before we had written languages, we have evidence of storytelling that was passed down. And as soon as we started, you know, domesticating animals, which is taking them out of the wild and using them against their will for our purposes to commodify them, this narrative of consent started emerging. Isn't that an interesting coincidence? Because it was really a response, a guilt response to what we were doing to them, using them against their will. It was a story that said, hey, we can do this because this is really what they want.
More than 150 billion animals are killed every year for human consumption. And Bill writes in, if we eliminated eating animals from the world, what would happen to those billions and billions of animals?
Well, obviously, this isn't going to happen overnight, is it? If we stop the breeding process, then we stop this whole engine. It's, you know, the same question could be asked of sweatshops. What do you do with all those people? Well, you know, you stop. First, you make the sweatshops. You shut them down, and then you find something for these people. You find an alternative. But these animals are only designed to live six weeks to a few months. So this process goes rather quickly for animals.
Robert Grillo is founder and director of Free From Harm and author of Farm to Fable, The Fictions of Our Animal-Consuming Culture. He'll be giving his Farm to Fable presentation tonight at 6 at the Rancho Cordova Library in Sacramento, 9845 Folsom. Friday night, he'll be at the Berkeley Animal Rights Center, 2425 Channing Way. Saturday at 2, he'll be at the Sonoma County Veg Fest at the Luther Burbank Center in Santa Rosa. Sunday at 1, he'll be at Animal Places Vegan Republic in Berkeley. That's a great vegan store. 1624 University. Robert, thank you for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about the future of right-wing media. If you saw any stories about that this week, please email them to us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes and leave us a review. If you have a show or guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sana Saleem produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.